I'd like now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Alan Wiseman. He's an award-winning journalist and author. We talked to him several years ago about his book, The World Without Us, and his new book is Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for Future on Earth. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. It's great to be back with you.
So this is a book about human population, which is arguably the underlying cause of many of the gigantic problems that we're facing, like climate change, pollution, food scarcity, species extinction, really every kind of ecological breakdown. Why is population talked about so little, especially when all these other things are talked about?
Well, because it makes us uncomfortable. You know, like any other organism, we are designed to make copies of ourselves. And that's just a natural act. And so the idea that we would have to limit a natural act feels, if you'll pardon the tautology here, unnatural. You know, in nature, organisms always stay kind of in balance with the carrying capacity of their environment, because if they get too numerous, nature knocks them back. And that used to happen to us, too. But then, over the past couple hundred years, we changed some things, you know, first with medical technology and then with food technology, and I'm sure we'll talk about that more. But 200 years isn't really that long a time for us to get rid of this instinctual feeling that we should be doing as much as we can to survive personally and also to produce plenty of offspring. You know, we used to produce extra copies of ourselves because some of them would die. It's really a completely different perceptual change that we're almost unequipped unless we really stand back and look objectively at the planet. I mean, you know, just think of what you just said. It underlies every environmental problem. A lot of people don't like that thought at all. On the other hand, you know, take away most of us, and obviously we'd have fewer environmental problems.
Now, you traveled to over 20 countries, and it's a journey even for the reader. I was getting tired just sitting on the couch reading about all the places that you went. But you start the book in Israel, which is a place full of contradictions, ecologically and socially. What were some of the ecological problems you saw in Israel and the way they're related to population?
Well, I started this book out in Israel and Palestine. I was in both places equally for two reasons. One is that this is a place on Earth that is emotionally deeply important to most of the human beings on the planet, you know, certainly the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims. And, you know, it really gets our attention. It's also one that we never think of in environmental terms. We think of it either in biblical terms or we think of it in political terms. And yet, the reason that civilization grew up there in the first place has to do with ecological reasons. And now what is taking place there right now underscore an awful lot of the politics. I'll explain. I mean, the obvious one, of course, is that Israel has all these settlements on the West Bank, and everybody says, why don't they do something reasonable and get rid of those, because that's what's causing the problem. Well, of course, the settlements are on top of the biggest aquifer, which runs through the West Bank, you know, in the region. And they're not going to give up water because water is a precious resource. It's a resource-poor area because about half of it's a sandbox. In fact, before the State of Israel was created in 1947, it was under British mandate, and the British ecologists determined that the carrying capacity of that land was about 3.5 million people maximum. The Zionist founder, who became the first prime minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, argued that Jewish ingenuity could make the desert bloom. And he insisted that they could have almost twice that number there, 6 million. Well, today there are nearly 12 million living between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. And by mid-century, if it keeps growing apace, there's going to be 21 1 million. You've got this classic situation of two communities or two peoples trying to outpopulate each other to be the majority in that land. And they're kind of running neck and neck now. The Palestinians just inched ahead, but the ultra-Orthodox Jews, who are having double-digit families to try to push this demographic derby in their favor, they may catch up in the 2020s sometime. So, you know, and they're running out of water. There's no way that this can continue forever, and yet we tend not to think of it in those terms.
I mean, when you look at animal populations and carrying capacity of an ecosystem for whatever species you're looking at, and that species exceeds the food supply that that creature needs, that species will tend to go beyond its optimal numbers before it crashes. And it can go way beyond its optimal numbers before it crashes. And then that crash is very ugly.
Yeah, and that's the reason why I wrote this book. I would like to avoid that for my species. You know, I'm glad you stated this question that way, because it's so simple for anybody to understand that in a confined area like a national park, you've got to keep a balance between predator and prey and the plant life that supports both of them. Yet, when it comes to our own species, it's just a lot more difficult. We're much more subjective. But, you know, there was a mandate not only in the Bible but in many religious texts from probably as many religions as, you know, there's ever been, to fill the earth and multiply. And we have filled the earth. I mean, it's really overfilled. We have stretched our population by technologically stretching that support system, but it's beginning to backfire on us in some really difficult ways. You know, I talk a lot about food in this book, and I talk about probably the most single important invention in the history of humankind is one that doesn't pop in anybody's mind because not that many people have heard about it. Something called the Haber-Bosch process. It was designed before World War One by a German chemist named Fritz Haber and a German engineer named Karl Bosch, and it was basically a way to pull nitrogen out of the sky and chemically slather it all over the land. Artificial nitrogen fertilizer greatly increased the amount of plant life on the planet. Before, it was limited to what a relatively few plants whose roots harbored bacteria that could fix nitrogen from the air and contribute to the soil. But now we could do that ourselves. And it's so significant because 40% of us would not be here if it wasn't for that. There simply wouldn't have been enough food for us all. So these kinds of things have allowed our numbers to increase enormously and rather suddenly, certainly in, you know, biological or geological time. But they're also getting us in a lot of trouble because the chemistry involved, first of all, it's an enormous contributor to greenhouse gas, both the fabrication of nitrogen fertilizer, and then when it breaks down into nitrous oxide, which after methane is the third most potent greenhouse gas. And also, we know what it does to our soils. It sterilizes them, it fouls rivers, and leaves chunks the size of New Jersey dead in the oceans at the mouths of our great rivers. So that kind of chemical forcing of our food supply, and the fact that we're using plants now that are more designed in laboratories than by nature, and they don't have natural defenses, so they require all kinds of assistance, usually in the form of poisons, you know, poisons against organisms that we don't prefer. But unfortunately, these poisons aren't as selective as their manufacturers would have us believe, so they start to affect us too. Right. And that's the way that we increase the food supply enormously. And it's not working very well. It may be one of the things that nature does to knock us back because, you know, I actually have several examples in the book that that's already starting to happen.
We're talking to Alan Wiseman about his book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. So this is the thing that what you have just talked about really pits two groups of people against each other in a way, which is those who believe in technology, that having new technologies can increase the carrying capacity of the earth, technologies that increase crop yields like the Haber-Bosch process and many other things, genetic engineering of seeds and so on. And it is tricky business that's illustrated by one of the stories in your book, namely the supposed green revolution in Punjab, India. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we should go a little bit back to talk about what the Green Revolution is. The Green Revolution was the second step in how we increased the food supply, the first one being artificial nitrogen fertilizer. In the 1960s, a plant geneticist named Norman Borlaug redesigned wheat. He basically created a shorter wheat plant so it put more of its energy into producing grain and could produce much more grain per stalk. And then those things were replicated in different ways with rice and with corn. And these enhanced crops, through genetic selection, they weren't tinkering with genes back then, averted famines that had been predicted for the world. They'd been predicted first, very theoretically, before there were even a billion people on the planet, by the infamous economist Robert Thomas Malthus. And then again in the 1960s by Paul and Ann Ehrlich in their seminal book, The Population Bomb, one of the books that really helped trigger the environmental movement. The famines, though, that they said were almost unavoidable in the 1970s in Asia didn't come to pass because Green Revolution crops were transported from the centers where they developed in Mexico and the Philippines to India and to Pakistan. And it saved the day, apparently. And today you constantly hear these techno-fixers that you're talking about say that the Green Revolution refuted Malthus and refuted Ehrlich. But here's what they forget. First of all, Norman Borlaug, when he won the Nobel Peace Prize, he's credited for saving more lives than anyone in human history. He stated in his acceptance speech, in fact, he ended his speech by saying that all we've done is really buy time. Unless enhanced food production and enhanced population control go hand in hand, we're not going to be able to keep ahead. Because what he understood was that the more people whose lives you save, then they live to beget more people, and so on. So today in India, it's about to surpass China as the most populous nation on the planet. And Pakistan, well, Pakistan has got 180, almost 190 million people in a country the size of Texas, which has 26 million people. By the middle of the century, if it keeps growing as it is, it's going to far outnumber today's United States, nearly 400 million, and it'll still be the size of Texas. And in the Punjab, which is shared by both countries, on the Indian side, that's the breadbasket. The head of the Green Revolution there introduced me to farmers. It took me to their villages, and they showed me that all the wells that were dug to water the Green Revolution crops were first 50 or 75 feet deep, but then they had to start digging deeper, and when it got to 250 and then 500, it became extraordinarily expensive. And today, a lot of those wells, more than 1,000 feet down. I spent a day talking mainly to widows of farmers who just gave up because they couldn't afford to keep digging, and they committed suicide. The staggering figure, which I can, from their farm union, which I confirmed with the Indian government, is that since 1995, 270,000 Green Revolution farmers in India have committed suicide, and the preferred method, very symbolic, is by drinking pesticide. So these farmers were quite convinced that we cannot keep going on with technical solutions because there's always a downside to them, and the downside is more food for more people takes more water, and there's only a limited supply of that. In fact, it's becoming scarcer. And then all the chemistry that supported the Green Revolution is ultimately not a healthy thing for us.
We have a big, huge question that you address in the book, which is, what is the optimal number of people on the Earth? And there's a lot of argument about that because there are vastly different consumption patterns that people have depending on whether they're rich or poor, rural or urban, omnivores or vegetarians, there is a hard limit to the food supply because there's only so much land and water and only so productive that it can be. And you've just talked about what happens when you push those limits. Have you come up with a number that you or the, you know, all the people you've talked to that you think is the optimal number of people on the planet?
Well, there are a couple numbers that are offered in the book from various ways of looking at it. But I should say first that, you know, you divided this between people who feel that population is a problem, people who feel that technology will solve all these problems. But there are other divides that I have to deal with in this book. And one is people who say it's not population, it's consumption. And if we all just consumed less, then there'd be plenty to go around for everyone. And I address that one in various ways. But the simple bottom line is that, okay, it's consumption. But, A, who's doing all the consuming? The more people who are consuming, the more consumption there is. And B, for those over-consumers out there, if anybody can come up with a way to convince them not to consume so much, I'll sign on. You know, we hear morality stated all the time, but it's rather hard to apply it. There's simply no condom for consumption that I've ever run into. But there is, you know, there are plenty of contraceptive devices that can help us limit the number of people. I'm not saying that we shouldn't distribute things more fairly, but I also am a realist here. You know, most food on the planet is not grown to nourish people. It's grown because to make profits. It's a commodity. So all that stated, one of the formulae that have been developed to figure out what would be optimum looks at energy outputs and looks at the amount of carbon dioxide that the planet can tolerate or the atmosphere can tolerate without changing life so much on the surface that our own civilization is at risk. And given that we're nearly at 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide right now, and the last time we had that, and the time before, in both instances, the seas were nearly 100 feet higher. That should be telling us something. A physicist at Berkeley did intense calculations trying to figure out what would be an amount of carbon dioxide, a minimum that would give us all a lifestyle that we would be satisfied with, or in the case of very poor people, aspire to, say, a European lifestyle, and then divide that by the number of people on the planet and figure out, you know, how many could live here. And he came up with something between 1.5 to 2 billion people. 1.5 would give us a lot more carbon allowance per person. And, of course, everyone says, well, you know, we can just replace all that carbon with renewables. Well, I'm not sure we can do that so quickly. I just came back from book tour in Germany, and Germany is trying very, very hard to do that. They're going to phase out nuclear power, and they want to produce most of their energy by the renewables by 2030. But it's a long way to get there, and Germany's got more money per capita than any other country right now. The rest of us can't really afford that very well. We've got energy companies who are stacked against doing it. And even if they weren't, you know, tomorrow we all just went to wind and solar. To mine the materials and to build the facilities to do that incurs a carbon debt that lasts a few decades before we're really getting zero emission energy. So part of the reason why I did this book was that I think the fastest thing that we can do to start to reduce the amount of carbon that we're throwing up into the atmosphere is by reducing the number of us who are expelling that carbon. Now, another way of looking at it, I've already hinted at, if we phased out artificial nitrogen fertilizer gradually over the next few decades, we'd be poisoning the system an awful lot less. We'd be coming back to what nature intended. And before artificial fertilizer became commercially available, there were 2 billion people on the planet. So that gives us a sense of a number that we could probably all live with. You know, at the beginning of the 20th century, there were only 1.6 billion people, and we had a pretty viable society then. We had, you know, critical mass of intellectual activity. We had inventors. We had medical breakthroughs. I would say, look, anything less than what we have right now, which is 7.2 billion, is going to be healthier because the planet's already bursting at its seams. Incidentally, you know, it's been believed for quite a while that we were going to level off at around 9.2 billion by the middle of this century because more people live in the cities and you don't need to have as many kids. You know, they're not farmhands in the cities. They actually cost money in the cities. But those figures have been revised. There's no peak in sight yet. We're going to, at this rate, be at nearly 11 billion by the end of this century. So we really have to start taking this seriously.
We're talking to Alan Wiseman about his book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Now, if we were to get to the number that you just spoke about, somewhere between 1.5 and 2 billion people, let's say 1.5 billion people, through conscious choice, through family planning and so on, as opposed to the horrors of plague and famine and war, will that number of people give ecosystems and species the chance to truly regenerate as if we weren't here at all? I mean, that was the premise of your first book, The World Without Us. If we weren't here, what would happen to the ecosystem? Would that number of people on Earth be sufficient?
You know, I wrote The World Without Us because I want a world with us. You know, I theoretically wiped us off the planet so we could see how well nature would recover and how surprisingly swiftly without our daily pressures, and then figure out, I hope readers would think, well, how do we add ourselves back into that picture? But when I realized, doing some math, that every 4 to 4.5 days we're adding 1 million people, I realized that that was not sustainable, and that's what led me to this new book, Countdown. Now, if there were only 1.5 billion of us on this planet, no, we'd still have an environmental impact, obviously, but every species has environmental impacts. We still would be leaving an awful lot of space for other species to survive and to thrive. I mean, right now, 40% of the planet is devoted to either cultivating or grazing food for us. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's just for one species. And this is not a sustainable number for biodiversity. What we don't really have to, though, worry about doing is something as coercive as China did. At the end of The World Without Us, I noted, or a very distinguished demographic institute noted for me, that if we all participated in the one-child policy tomorrow, by the end of the century, that's exactly where we'd be. We'd be back to 1.6 billion,
right.
Which would give a lot more room for everything, including ourselves. But no one likes the one-child policy. Even the Chinese don't like it, and they're now relaxing it, though actually kind of slightly. But one of the reasons I went to 21 countries was to find out, well, are there alternatives to it? And I found many different examples, including in some very surprising places like Muslim countries, because a lot of people in Europe feel that Muslims are just going to proliferate and overrun them. But countries that have brought themselves down below replacement rate, that's two people having two children, you know, thus replacing themselves. And in one case, even faster than China. And they've done it through making family planning very attractive to people because they get the idea that they can live a better life if they only have two kids to take care of rather than having seven. This is also fairly logical stuff.
Well, that's something that, on the one hand, we've been told since the beginning of time to be fruitful and multiply, and family planning, as you said at the beginning, kind of goes against our nature. But for women, once they get the idea of family planning, I mean, in Western culture and in some of these other places that you visited, once you start having 0 to 2 kids, nobody really wants to have 7 to 10 kids anymore. What did you see? Tell us some of your stories.
Yeah, you know, the idea of being fruitful and multiply is the way every culture begins. In the Bible, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are polygamous for the same reason the Mormons were later on. It's a strategy to have a lot of kids and become bigger than your neighbors so they don't usurp you. But then you come down to Joseph, who may be history's first recorded ecologist, because he realizes that we're entering a time of scarcity. And he just has one wife and two children, and he counsels the Israelites and the Pharaoh to do the same. You know, that this is not a time to keep expanding if they want to survive, but to conserve. So I found in many different cultures and religions, there are precedents for this kind of behavior to, so to speak, refrain from embracing so much. And the surprising country that I mentioned was Iran, which is the last country that I visited. After its 1979 Islamic Revolution, they actually first did the opposite, because they were attacked by Saddam Hussein, who had the backing of NATO, by the way, and a lot of sophisticated weaponry. Iran just had people. So the Ayatollah asked every female in Iran who was fertile to get pregnant to help build a 20-million-man army to fight off the invaders. And they held them to a stalemate for 8 years. But after that, the planning and budget director of Iran realized that they were going to have this terrible problem. They were going to never, their economy was not going to be able to employ all these kids when they grew up. And he warned the Ayatollah that a nation filled with under or unemployed young men is a nation filled with frustration and anger, and it gets destabilized, sort of describing Pakistan, which is another country I go to in this book. So they instituted a family planning program, but it was totally voluntary. People could have as many kids as they wanted. The only compulsory thing was to attend premarital classes. Now, that's actually a smart idea for anybody, frankly, and the American Quakers do that. In those classes, among other things, you learned how much it costs to raise and feed and educate a child. He issued a fatwa. That's the current Ayatollah, actually, saying that there's nothing in the Quran that says that wisdom dictates you have the number of children you can responsibly care for, that nothing against using any form of birth control, even up to vasectomy or tubal ligation. And then Iran made all that birth control available. I have a wonderful story that was told to me by a very devout Muslim woman who's an OBGYN in Tehran. They used to go on horseback to the farthest villages, bringing surgical teams to make sure everybody could choose how many kids they wanted. And the last thing, most important, they encouraged women to stay in school. Back then, only about a third of Iranian women were literate. Today, 60% of university students in Iran are female. A woman who goes to school defers her childbearing until her studies are done, generally. And then once she's out, she's got something interesting and useful, economically helpful to her family to do, but she can't exercise those skills if she has seven kids. So overwhelmingly, rich or poor country, educated women tend to have two children or fewer. That makes female education the best contraception on the planet. If we were to make contraception tools available to everybody to choose whether to use them, and if we educated women, that would be the single most effective and fastest thing that we could do to improve the situation of our impact on the environment.
And there's another upside to that, because if you have educated women, the birth rate gets lower. Not only is it good for the earth, but you can really make the case that it's also good for society, as it gets women out of the house. They have more time to participate in public life and politics and professions and basically be citizens as well as mothers, which tends to be a good thing and lead to less war and stuff like that.
Well, I personally would agree with that statement. Now, some people who more coldly or clinically analyze how society works might consider that to be a little bit too fuzzy for them, but a lot of those people are economists, and they're the ones who complain a lot about the idea of population management, because they like big populations. And one of the reasons that they like them is because the more people that are out there, the cheaper labor is. You know, it's really a way of squeezing poor people. But you constantly hear people them say, well, in a shrinking population, you're going to have this big balloon of senior citizens, and you're going to have fewer young people paying into the tax office to take care of them. Well, a lot of educated women would really help that labor shortage. And that labor imbalance would really only exist for a generation or so, because then the numbers of old and young would level off as the last overgrown old generation dies off. That's happening in today's Japan right now. It's another country I go to in this book. Japan had to cut off its baby boom at the end of World War II because their economy was wrecked and they were starving to death. So rather than watch more pregnant women throw themselves in front of trains. They legalized abortion in 1949, and as a result, there's a much smaller generation of baby boomers that are now replacing, you know, that last overgrown pre-war born generation. And a lot of Japanese economists are terrified about this, but I follow a visionary Japanese economist who's actually not a radical. He's in a major policy institute who sees this as opportunity for Japan. It's inevitable that population has to come down, and, you know, right before I was there, Fukushima gave them another reason why it would be better if there were fewer of them demanding energy. And ultimately, he said, what's going to happen is that they won't have to depend on these big, heavy, crowded port cities with, you know, heavy industry for export. It's going to be lighter industries, more people, and I follow some of these young people that he's referring to that are now moving into the interior because farmland and houses are cheap as a large older generation dies off. And he says what will happen is actually wages are going to remain high because fewer workers, they're going to be more valuable. But as demand lowers with smaller generation, smaller population, which is another way of lowering consumption, he says then working hours will just be reduced and we'll have more leisure time and more space to enjoy it. And this is not a bad vision of the future, frankly.
There's something really weird about your Japan chapter, which is that part of what's going on is that they've got successful birth control based on people not having sex.
Yeah, I would agree with you that it is weird. I have a little story in there where young Japanese women, all of them, I would add, extremely attractive. Some of them married, some of them not, sitting around and talking about the fact that they just don't have sex anymore. And there's government studies that show that that is the case. I would consider that an anomaly on the planet. Most other countries that I went to, people are having sex. It may be just a Japanese thing. I couldn't ignore it because a lot of them said that this was really significant. But frankly, what's really significant is that, again, Japan cut off its baby boom, and they have such a high level of education, most Japanese women are professionals. And I think what happens is the Japanese work way too many hours, and at night they're just kind of too exhausted.
Ah, very interesting. Now, there's another really interesting thing about your Japan chapter, which is that there's this very old and beautiful tradition in Japan of living with nature and doing agriculture in harmony with nature, which has its own very beautiful aesthetic, and you describe these places so vividly, and this led me to wonder whether you think there's a connection between survival and beauty.
Well, of course there is. You know, a lot of people say, well, the human race is a cancer on the planet. I don't consider us cancerous at all. We deserve to be here as much as any other species, and when we are living in harmony with nature, it's a very, very beautiful thing. Human life, you know, our communities are in every way just as lovely as the rest of nature, of which we are a part. It's only when we become overwhelming, when we start to maul everything around us, that things get ugly. That you know, when you think of Japan, particularly if you've never been there, you know, you think of these beautiful pastoral scenes and, you know, the ink and watercolors that show us, you know, these pastoral landscapes. But there's always people in those landscapes. And that is what is, I think, in the offing for Japan in the coming decades, to reestablish that. And as you say, I do go to examples of it. And it's lovely. It feels right to be a human being, not, you know, like a guilty feeling, like, oh, you know, we're enjoying our good lifestyle at the expense of everything else, including our own future.
We're talking to Alan Wiseman about his book, Countdown. So when you think about a shrinking population, and there is some hope that birth control, which you, I think, really beautifully argue is the best techno fix to our ecological problems than just simply the technology of birth control. But let's say we manage to really reduce the population of this planet significantly. Well, our economic model is based on growth, and as you point out, continual growth will eventually destroy us. So what kinds of economic models do we have to replace the growth model? Can there be prosperity without economic growth? Are we looking to worldwide unemployment? What could it look like?
Well, that's one of the big questions I set out to answer here. And first of all, the idea that growth is the definition of economic health is something that we have been, you know, that's been sold to us because it's to the advantage of the growers. Again, the more people on the planet, you know, the more consumers there are for products. That's one thing. And the United States actually said that during the Reagan administration at the World Population Conference, when we pulled the plug out of from family planning funding for much of the world. Also, again, the more people on the planet, the cheaper labor becomes. Actually, I've talked to many economists and bankers for this book who say that there's no reason why we can't have a steady state economy. Even Adam Smith, I mean, literally the great first definer of capitalism, if you read him, he says that at a certain point, economies can't keep growing forever. The world, you know, the earth isn't growing. They level off at a healthy place. The idea that we constantly need to have more and more workers is, you know, really doesn't hold up when you analyze what it takes to run a company. I mean, I at the end of the book, I say this way. You know, suppose you hire one of those pro-growth economists to be a consultant to your factory or to your company. The first thing he's going to tell you is cut out the fat, get lean, you know, get more efficient. So what are you supposed to do? You know, you come down to sustainable size by cutting out 25% of your workforce, handing them pink slips. Or you can do it more humanely as people, you know, retire or pass on or move away. You just get more efficient. You use technology that can help perform more of those tasks with fewer people, and you recruit fewer people to take their place, and your company comes down to a healthier, more manageable, economically healthier size. Well, that's exactly what we should be doing with our planet, frankly, is recruiting fewer people to replace ourselves in the future. I asked about investment, and there are mechanisms which don't involve a volatile stock market where you can make a killing right away or lose it really fast, but long-term bonds, they call them perpetual bonds, where your money is investing in creativity, which capitalism is very good at, and yet not trying to make, you know, some enormous profit, but a long-term, steady state, dependable kind of, you know, if not gain on your savings, at least an assurance that the savings are not going to be are not going to suddenly disappear, as they have done in us when we have tried to create financial instruments to keep growth going beyond reality, such as inventing phony mortgages for so many people who really couldn't afford mortgages.
Right.
It's kind of too long a discussion, and I guess I'm going to ask your listeners to read the book to get more of an idea of the ways that we can have a sustainable economy. But the important thing to note is that the Japanese economist who I feature in this says that this will happen over a few decades. It's not something that we're going to suddenly stop doing one thing and start another thing. That would be too abrupt, and we would have that huge unemployment that you're talking about. But as we bring the economy more towards a sustainable, steady kind of structure, as we are bringing population down, which we can do over the next couple of generations. I mean, Japan cut off their baby boom in 1940, but only now, two generations later, are they really starting to see the effect of that, then these things can go hand in hand. And there's a chance for us to avoid a severe collapse, both economically and ecologically.
I think there's a big kind of secret, what is it, the elephant in the middle of the room, about growth, which is that, I mean, the argument is that growth benefits everybody because a company expands and there's more jobs and so on. But if you look at it closely, growth really affects the captains of industry, the wealthy, the investors, people who aren't doing the work in the first place. And for the vast majority of people who are actually workers, if that money weren't being siphoned off to the people who didn't earn it, you could have a steady state economy right now.
Well, you're right. And look, the proof of your statement is the fact that we now have the most unbelievable economic disparity in our nation and in this planet, on this planet, you know, that we have seen since feudal times. And this is not a sustainable situation. It's always an imbalance. When civilizations get too top-heavy, they topple. And that's where we are headed unless we start turning this thing around. Now, it would be incredibly inexpensive to do what I suggested before is the best and fastest thing that we can do to improve the prospects for preserving the environment that allows humanity to exist. For to provide universal contraception, so everybody who wanted to use it, or you know, who chose to use it, would have access to it. That would cost less per year than the United States was spending per month in Iraq and Afghanistan during the last decade, about $8.1 billion. This is totally affordable. And we're well on the way. We're spending about half that right now, and about half the world's nations are at, below, or near replacement rate. What we need to do is bring everybody else. And I know some people, again, will say, well, the poor people of the world, their environmental impact is nothing compared to the rest of us. Well, I go to some of the poorest countries in the world in this book, and everybody has an environmental impact. They're living out in the countryside. They need food. They need water. And they need shelter, and they're cutting down trees left and right. If they move to the cities, I don't care how poor they are, because I go to some of the worst slums in the world for this book. Somehow they're getting cell phones and they're plugging in their chargers every night, the same as you and me. So this is something that we have to do across the board. I'm totally in agreement with the argument that the United States is the most overpopulated country on the planet when you multiply our consumption by our numbers. We all have to come down. And yes, we have to keep looking for renewable energy sources. We have to keep doing everything we possibly can. But if we do all of those things and we don't bring our population back to manageable numbers, we're just not going to be able to do it.
We're talking to Alan Wiseman. Now, you traveled far and wide, as we've discussed, to write this book. What places do you think represent our best and worst possible futures?
Well, you know, Iran is not the only country that reversed an incredible population growth, and you know, they brought their population rate down to replacement a year faster than China did. I show Thailand, you know, a Buddhist country that did the same thing, but with a much different way of approaching it. It's actually one of the funniest things I've ever written, because it's a hilarious story how they got everybody in Thailand laughing over the idea of family planning. And
yeah,
I'll leave that to people's imagination.
Oh, God, it was fantastic. Well, let's just say people find condoms fascinating.
It's totally charming. And they even, you know, this is a country that has a sex industry as one of its economic pillars. And that one was kind of easy, you know, because it happened right around the time that AIDS was rearing its ugly head. And they simply appeal to people and say, in that industry, and say, I mean, do you really want to be an industry that makes your clients sick? And the easy way to avoid that was by using condoms. You know, Mexico, you know, the population pressures in this country wouldn't even have existed if Mexico would have had family planning earlier than they do. But now they have a wonderful program, and it's basically due to an enlightened series of soap operas that made it seem very attractive to have just a small family and very problematic to have many kids. And you can see as the viewership rose of those soap operas, you can see the fertility rate in Mexico declining during the 1980s. It's really, really kind of wonderful. So what's hopeful to me is that many different kinds of countries, it's something that's culturally applicable to them works. You know, I go to the Vatican. I have some pretty interesting encounters in the Vatican over this issue. But the Vatican is 110 acres populated by 1,000 gray-haired men, mainly, surrounded by a very Catholic country called Italy, which has one of the lowest fertility rates on the planet because Italian women are some of the per capita highest best educated women on the planet. So that stuff, to me, is very hopeful. The stuff that was really devastating, you know, I already talked about Pakistan. That country's a nuclear power, and it's out of control. When I was there, there was mayhem in the streets every day. There were grenade battles. There were shootings. Two of the guys that I went to interview because they had a program that was preserving the mangrove forests around Karachi Harbor. I got there a day late. They were found floating dead in the lagoon, tortured because the timber mafia wanted to muscle in on those mangroves. And we can't afford this all over the planet. But you know, once again, the hopeful stories outnumber the hopeless ones in this book. Even in Pakistan, five businessmen go out one day complaining about how bad off their country is, and then they decide to do something about it. So they start their own school system, because their kids would say the teacher only shows up on payday. And in the poorest parts of the country, they start these co-educational schools. They want boys and girls growing up together so they can respect each other. In secondary school, the kids pick a profession they think they might be interested in. So girls pick, you know, a female doctor or a nurse, a flight attendant, school teacher, and they get paired with a mentor. And what they see is that these professional women get to do what they do because they only have a couple of kids. So they never even have to talk about family planning. These girls get the idea. And it's not that hard to do. And as you said, what a benefit to society if we have all these educated females.
Alan Wiseman's book is called Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Now, how has your book been received so far? Are people opening up to the idea of having a real conversation about population? Have you gotten pushback?
Surprising little pushback. I expected a lot more. I expected attacks from the Catholic Church and from, you know, APAC, the American Israeli Political Action Committee, because, you know, I think fairly about the Palestinians. You know, and I have great admiration for a lot of the things that Israel has done, but you know, both Israeli ecologists and Palestinian ecologists told me how concerned they were about what is going on with this ridiculous population competition that they have there. I've just returned from Germany. Actually, I just really returned from Canada. That's where I was last night. And the book is now going to be coming out in 13 more languages so far. So what I'm seeing is increased attention to it. I even got a really very, very favorable and thoughtful review in the Wall Street Journal about this book. So I'm hoping that, as so many people have said to me, you know, you think about it, it's just logical. Of course we can.
Yeah.
There's too many of us.
Yeah.
It's hard for us to think about it because you and me and everybody else listening to this was born during the big population bubble when our numbers quadrupled during the 20th century because of enhanced medicine and enhanced food production. We don't realize it. This is the abnormal part of human existence. Before, just a very, very slight increase defined our species. And nature is not going to let abnormality exist for long. Ultimately, we're going to come back down to some kind of steady state resolution with the rest of nature, or, you know, I hope our population crash isn't a fatal one. I hope it's one that we manage gracefully rather than letting nature do it for us, because that won't be so pretty.
Alan Wiseman, it's a wonderful book full of incredible stories, which we can't even begin to cover on the radio, so I hope lots of people read it. And thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's always a pleasure.